This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The world's eyes have turned to Canada this week as the country has faced two terror attacks in rapid succession. Yesterday, a shooter gunned down a soldier at the War Memorial in Ottawa and was then shot and killed by the sergeant at arms as the shooter rushed into Parliament. On Monday, a Quebecer who police describe as recently radicalized ran over two Canadian soldiers with his car, killing one. He was later shot and killed by municipal police. We're going to get some perspective on how people in Montreal and Quebec are reacting to these two events and find out what more is known now from Genevieve Beauchemin, Montreal Bureau Chief for CTV. Genevieve, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Yeah, thank you. Hi.
Can you describe what it feels like to be living in Quebec right now, the mood, the conversations, the concern people are feeling?
Well, you know, in every coffee shop, people are talking about exactly what happened. And there's a sense of fear. There's a sense of shock, of course, because this is something that doesn't seem to be something that would happen in Canada. It doesn't seem like it would happen in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, this small town, 100,000 people, a military town for generations. There was a fort there that was established in 1666, and there have been military men there, military men and women there since then. And so a sense of shock about what's happened over the last few days. And really, when the attack happened on Monday, there had been a lot of people talking about it, a sense of fear, a sense of shock. And then things were starting to get back to normal because, in a sense, people were talking about the fact that this was an isolated attack. They felt as though this had happened. There had been a person that they described, many of them describing as a deranged person. Okay, we understand this is terrifying, but we can put it behind us. And then again, they were faced yesterday with the terror attack in Ottawa, and that sent people into that deeper sense of fear, grief about the loss of these two soldiers who died, two families that are grieving. And so certainly there's a thought as to what could happen possibly next.
Genevieve, you mentioned a little bit about Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, where the first incident took place. Can you describe the town a little bit more for people who are not so familiar with it? It's a suburb of Montreal.
It is. It's about 50 kilometers southeast of Montreal. It's not far from Lake Champlain. It is a town that, as I say, was built around a fort in 1666. It is a town of about 100,000 people, and it has been, there's a Royal Military College as well there. You would see people walking around in uniform there, and a lot of family people, people who would be working, some of them in the Montreal area, but some of them in the town as well. It's a very friendly town. A lot of people would just, you know, the regular towns around those areas, around the Rivière de Richelieu, where people would be talking, everybody would know one another pretty much. Everybody would have known who this person is, at least have seen him, at least have come across him at some point, who the suspect in this attack would have been. And so certainly sent shockwaves through the town on Monday.
Yes, this suspect was known in town. He grew up there, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Absolutely. Martin Couture-Rouleau grew up in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, and he went to the local high school, and I spoke to some of his high school friends who were describing him as just a regular guy, a normal guy from a normal family. They say perhaps he was a little bit withdrawn in high school, as many high schoolers are, perhaps a little bit shy, but nothing to indicate that there could be a problem, many of his high school friends say. A polite young man, they say. And then things started to happen in his life. Friends say that about 2 years ago, he seemed to get into more trouble. He seemed to have family issues. He was married. He had a son, but he broke up with his wife. He started up a business with business partners that was an industrial cleaning company. And then that business, there was a lot of trouble with the business. He had financial problems. He was bankrupt as well. And then they say this is when he turned to Islam, and he converted to Islam in April 2013. And then they say after that he talked a lot about conspiracy theories. He had online rantings which worried many members of his family. And many members of his family became so concerned that they called police. They called authorities to warn them that things weren't right with him, and they were fearful about what would happen. The RCMP started monitoring him. They kept tabs on him. And then in July 2014, they actually arrested him as he was on his way out. He was at the airport. He was heading to Turkey. And so they felt that he was going to Turkey to fight for ISIS. And so they removed his passport, but they couldn't charge him with a crime. So they let him go, but they decided to keep tabs on him, keep meeting with him. They met with his family. They say the family was very cooperative. They were intent on trying to help him. There was also the local imam who came to the meetings. There were police outreach officers who tried to deal with him. They last had a meeting with him on October 9th. And in that meeting, police have told us that it was a very extensive meeting. And at that time, Martin Couture-Rouleau seemed to be intent on changing, that he seemed to show some openness towards wanting to change his radical thoughts, they said. And then 11 days later, he ran down the two pedestrians in that strip mall, so the two soldiers in that strip mall. So police are saying that now their investigation will try to focus on exactly what it is that happened, what they missed, what they could have done differently, or what it is that happened between that meeting and that day Monday.
So obviously a lot of investigation still to go. In the meantime, what kind of security measures have been taken at the military base?
Now, this is something that's very sad to a lot of people in the town. They've had to increase security, of course, at all bases across the country now, but in Saint-Jean itself as well. And there's much more military police around the area. They have not locked down the base, but they're controlling people who are coming in and out more closely. But what has been something that most people are talking about is that the soldiers have been told, have been ordered, in fact, not to wear their uniforms in public. So they're not to go anywhere where they're not on active duty while wearing their uniform. As I say, this is something that would have been a common sight in the town, and now it's gone. And some of the soldiers we were talking to earlier this week were saying, well, it has been ordered. I will follow that order, but it makes me sad because I'm so proud of wearing this uniform and I want to wear it to honor these two fallen soldiers, these two fallen brothers, and now I can't wear it, but I understand that we are being targeted. It does make me a target. So a source of a lot of discussions in town.
We're talking with Geneviève Beauchemin. She's the CTV Montreal Bureau Chief, and we're getting some updates on what's been happening in Canada this week and specifically what's been happening in Quebec since Monday. It is still early, but has any connection been made between Monday's incident in Saint-Jean and yesterday's in Ottawa?
Not at the moment. As you say, it is still early, but it is obviously something that police are looking at very closely. Michael Zihaf Bibo, he's the shooter in Ottawa, and police are digging into his background. He has an extensive criminal record. He lived here in the Montreal area as well. He also lived in Vancouver. He also lived in other places in Canada. So they're trying to put all the pieces together, try to track his whole history, try to understand if he became radicalized, what his motives were. He doesn't have the same internet footprint that Martin Couture-Rouleau had, but they're going to dig into that. There's been a lot of talk as to whether his passport had been taken away or he'd been denied a passport. That's something that police are still trying to ascertain. And they're also, of course, going to be looking at very closely as to whether Martin Couture-Rouleau and Michael Zihaf Bibo had talked, had made any sort of connection online. It's not something that's obvious at the moment. There's not a network there that seems to be standing out, but it is something that police will have to be looking at closely. Did they come across one another in any sort of chat rooms, in any sort of discussions? Did they ever have something beyond something that is obvious in terms of a posting on a Twitter account? Did they have discussions? Obviously, a key piece of this investigation.
Well, or barring that, were they operating under the same set of instructions from a similar organization?
Well, that's an excellent question. This is something that they will be looking at. And, of course, what we've heard is there's been the ISIS call to arms. There mm-hmm. have been a lot of people talking about a lot of radicals inciting people, talking about the fact that they should, for instance, chillingly use their cars to ram people down who have contributed to the fight against ISIS. And that is exactly what was done in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu. So that has been a chilling aspect. So is there some sort of network there? We don't know. It is a distinct possibility that these people were acting on their own, that they were lone wolves, but that they were following the same set of instructions, as you say, from above, but not necessarily as part of a network. This is all something that has to be determined here.
Well, and you know, obviously neither of these incidents could have been anticipated, but Canada did heighten its terror threat level last Friday before either of these attacks. And what about now? Where is the threat level?
the threat level is the highest at the moment. Yes, they did raise it Friday, which has led to a lot of questions. There were a lot of questions as to whether this was related at all to any threats that were made of the kind that we saw, the attacks that we saw bear out. Police have told us that no, that this was a terror threat level. They're not telling us exactly why the terror threat level was raised. We do know that there were warplanes, the CF-18s, left here on Tuesday to join the fight against ISIS in Iraq, and so certainly that did increase, that did make military targets here in Canada more vulnerable. So is it simply related to that, or was there any more information out there that these attacks were more likely, is a good question. Police do say, though, however, in the case of Martin Couturoulot, they did not have any reason to believe that he would carry out an attack. They said that after that October 9th meeting that they had, they felt pretty secure, pretty certain that things were on the right track in that particular area, though they were going to keep an eye on him. But that is not the suspect that led to the terror threat level being increased.
Geneviève Beauchemin is the Montreal Bureau Chief for CTV. Geneviève, thank you very much for talking with us. Appreciate it.
Goodbye, Jane.
Coming up, we'll look at how Efficiency Vermont works to save Vermonters' electricity and how its mission might change in the future. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. One of the state's largest utilities doesn't generate electricity at all. It saves it. Efficiency Vermont was set up more than a decade ago to help Vermont reduce its demand for electricity. Its budget is paid for by a surcharge on all of our electric bills, and Efficiency Vermont says it has saved the state much more than it costs to run itself. In fact, the utility says Vermont uses 13% less electricity than it would if Efficiency Vermont wasn't around. But many Vermonters today could use help with thermal efficiency, cutting their oil or propane bills and tightening up their houses. That's not in the scope of Efficiency Vermont, but the utility is asking Vermonters to think about how they might want to change the mission and what would be most useful. Today on the program, we're going to learn a bit more about how Efficiency Vermont operates and hear from several people who have ideas about how it could be tweaked. If you want to add your voice to the mix, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. In the studio with me now is Jim Merriam, Executive Director of Efficiency Vermont. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So your role in the state portfolio is to save the state electricity, but you actually describe it in a kind of a somewhat confusing but interesting way about generating electricity when you're not sort of generating electricity. Can you describe how you describe what you do?
Sure. Hopefully I'll try to do it a little clearer. So what we do is we actually take power off the grid, which is the same, has the same effect as generating power. So Efficiency Vermont is a utility, but as opposed to generating power, we actually save power. And the end result for Vermonters is we're able to save power at a cost that's half the cost of buying that power.
So you describe it sort of as buying power the most cheaply in the state, because you're taking it sort of off the grid.
I think arguably we could say we generate the cheapest and cleanest power for the state of Vermont.
Because you're not generating any at all.
Exactly.
So how do you calculate that you save the state 13% of what we would otherwise be using?
It's a rather rigorous process that I won't drag you completely through. But independently, third-party verified, we can only claim savings, that 13%, on things that are directly attributable to the actions that we take. So, for instance, if Vermonters take action on their own independent of work that we would do, that's not part of that 13%.
But it is, you have calculated it using a lot of different rubrics to try to make sure that that's accurate.
Everything we do has a certain amount of savings, energy savings associated with it. And all of those little individual actions total up to being able to contribute to that 13%, as you said. And it may be a better way for context for listeners is after Vermont Yankee closes, energy efficiency will be the largest source of energy produced in the state of Vermont.
Can you monetize that? What do you think you're saving Vermonters in terms of cost?
Well, if I think about it in terms of what we're trying to accomplish in our next 3 years, the benefits that in savings that we're trying to generate Vermonters is $350 million. That's actually a requirement of us in our next 3-year performance period. We have to generate $350 million worth of energy savings for Vermonters.
Does that trickle down to each individual Vermonter? I mean, can I figure that I'm saving something that I otherwise wouldn't?
Well, there's direct and there's indirect ways that you can benefit from this. So obviously, if you participate, if you go to a hardware store and you pick up a light bulb that we've worked to help bring down the cost of an efficient light bulb, you should be able to see savings on your bill. But even if Vermonters aren't participating, there's a benefit that they can derive from this, because one of the benefits that Efficiency Vermont brings to the entire system is when we use less energy as a state, we can defer a lot of costs in terms of building new transmission lines or building new generation plants that cost a lot of money. Now, unfortunately, you don't see those savings in your bill in terms of deferred generation or deferred building of transmission lines, but that's a real savings that's brought back to Vermonters. In fact, I think it was Velco that did an analysis and said that the work that Efficiency Vermont has done has deferred $275 million worth of transmission upgrades.
Is that just, I mean, that word deferred can mean some different things, though. Is that deferred maintenance that we are going to have to do at some point? You know, are we losing money?
It's projects that didn't have to happen because of efficiency. So
but when we look at more efficient designs and upgrading our grid, are we saving the same amount of money as we would if we had actually upgraded, you know, some of those systems already?
I'll see if I can answer the question that you're asking. We can go and meet our reliability needs to make sure that every Vermonter has power a couple different ways. One is you continue to build, and that costs money to both maintain and to build. The other is to reduce so that you never need that power to begin with. So the cheapest way to do that is to not build it in the first place.
We're talking with Jim Merriam. He is the head of Efficiency Vermont. We're looking at what this utility does in the state, how it saves electricity, and how its mission could be changing. It's actually having some forums around the state starting next week to talk to Vermonters about what Efficiency Vermont does and what Vermonters would like it to do. If you want to weigh in on that, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So you work in a number of different ways. One of them is subsidizing LED light bulbs, so Vermonters can get an LED light bulb for $5 flat, no matter where they're going, right?
Yes,
$4.99. So you save that extra penny, too.
Yes.
And another one is something that was perhaps more controversial, which was $5 million that Efficiency Vermont put into helping ski resorts this year get more efficient snow guns for snowmaking. That was a little bit controversial. Can you talk a little bit about that first, and we'll get into some of the other things you
do? I would love to. So first and foremost, Efficiency Vermont serves everyone in this entire state of Vermont. So we serve residential customers and business customers. So when items like the snowmaking come up, there's a series of questions that we go through to actually figure out whether or not we should do it. So the first one that we would look at is the incentive that we're offering the ski areas on scale with the contribution that they've made to the efficiency fund. And in this particular case, the answer was yes. Ski areas use a lot of energy and have paid in money, a lot of money to the efficiency fund. So we saw the scale between what we're offering for an incentive and what they paid in and will pay in the future very much in alignment. We also look at things like, if we didn't make this investment, would it have happened? And history has shown, even despite being able to identify what the most efficient snow guns were, that action hadn't taken place. So these guns use 90%, 85 to 90% less energy. And that's a real benefit in terms of savings to them. And then, again, going back to that, how does everybody benefit? That reduces a lot of strain on the grid. And then for all of those reasons, as a utility, it made sense to do it. There's a whole other side of benefits that generate out of this as well. So when you think about ski areas, they're located in geographically dispersed, remote sections of the state where often they are the major employer. And this helps support that effort and creates jobs. Additionally, if you look around ski areas, there's a lot of small businesses that rely on the health of those ski areas to be able to be viable and be in business. So again, it supports more than the ski areas. It supports that whole community that's been built around these ski areas. And then if you just think through what's Vermont's brand, it's about green. And this helped really draw attention to Vermont ski areas and caught a lot of national media attention in terms of, boy, Vermont's got this really right, which will drive a lot of skiers to Vermont that then in turn turns into tourism dollars through rooms and meals that helps fund our tax base that can then drive a lot of good programs.
Although I guess it remains to be seen whether skiers are going to find it enough of a draw to know that there are efficient snow guns to come to Vermont unless the snow, I mean, it seems like the snow, the quality of the snow is going to be a more important factor.
Well, these snow guns do produce a higher quality snow. And I've actually seen a lot of the postings around the country. Actually, Efficiency Maine copied what we did because they were afraid that Maine would lose skier visits to Vermont. And then I've seen some things in New York where they have said, we're really afraid that people are going to be skiing in Vermont because they really got it right. So it has caught some attention. And from a scale perspective, has actually brought a lot of additional value to it.
Not specifically about the snow gun program, but we got a note from Craig who looks at what Efficiency Vermont does and how it's funded, which is through a surcharge on our electricity bills. And Craig says, efficient lighting is important, but we don't need Efficiency Vermont gouging our electric bills just to tell us the obvious. Let the market determine whether we save electricity and what products we should use. We don't need this large subsidized organization interfering with good productive practices in our homes and businesses. So how do you counter Craig's idea that Efficiency Vermont, you know, maybe shouldn't exist at all? It should be market forces determining this.
I mean, I would definitely agree with Craig, I think, in the premise that Vermonters are smart. And that's somewhat self-serving. We're both Vermonters here as well. But I think that there's some benefits that may be missed. First and foremost, again, for every dollar we take in, we deliver back $2 of benefits. But to bring that down to maybe something that's a little more practical, I know as an individual, I can't go into a store and find a $4.99 LED bulb. And if you think of Efficiency Vermont, not just on that scale, but on a lot of other scales, as a large buying club, our combined efforts help actually create and leverage more opportunity for Vermonters. So while I appreciate the sentiment, I understand what they're talking about, there's a lot of benefits to the scale that we bring. And that light bulb is an example on the residential side. On the business side, we do some things like the snow guns. Again, we help bring scale and actually got the manufacturers of that product to lower their price, which a ski area on their own could not have achieved. And we also use both technical assistance and certain contractors to be able to bring in a specific expertise that we can leverage across a lot of organizations very efficiently and very cost effectively that would be difficult for any one individual to do.
One of the things I think that not everybody understands about Efficiency Vermont is you really are in your whole mission. Your mission is focused on electric efficiency, power efficiency. We're not talking about heating my home with oil heat and how I can retrofit my house to make that more efficient in your mission.
So our mission is to help support both helping keep your home warm and weatherize it, and to do and promote electric efficiency.
But with a much, much greater focus
and funding
on the electric side.
So on the practical side, about 90% of our funding is centered around electric efficiency. And we use our limited funds on the thermal side to leverage as much as possible and as much good as possible. But I think the interesting thing over time we're starting to see is now we're starting to see new technologies like heat pumps that are starting to blur those lines. So electric technologies that actually heat the home. So I think that's something that we're very much engaged in terms of making sure that our mission, our structure supports, I think, really good questions from Vermonters and concerns from Vermonters, which is, how do I heat my home cheaply? And I think it's going to actually see, we're going to see over time that both electric and thermal are going to come together.
Well, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that with your heat pump project that's just getting underway now and how you're doing that and how you can actually sort of have a sense where you're creating something that uses more electricity for people, but in effect saves them money because they are being more efficient with
Correct.
Their heating. So we'll get more into that. But as you're talking here about thermal efficiency and electric efficiency merging and what Vermonters are needing. Let's bring in another voice. Ludi Biddle is the executive director of NeighborWorks Vermont. That's an organization that helps Vermonters purchase and stay in their homes, and that includes helping lower-income Vermonters weatherize their homes. Ludi, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
So what do the people that you work with need help from that you think Efficiency Vermont could help them with?
Well, we've been working for the last several years with Rutland County in particular, and recently we've expanded to five counties, where we've encouraged homeowners to go through the retrofit program, the home performance with Energy Star program that Efficiency Vermont so ably set up several years ago, and for which we're very grateful, all the training and all the technical aspects that have gone into setting that up. But we have encouraged, we've now had 890 households in Rutland County go through the program, and they're saving around 30% on their energy costs, all in electric, thermal, everything, which has meant about almost $1 million a year savings among those in Rutland County that have done it. And we all need that. We all need those savings. We all need the comfort and the health benefits that come from weatherizing our homes. And we all need, so, you know, what I would be so grateful for as we're, you know, going forward, that we at the Heat Squad and other programs that stand on the very tall shoulders of Efficiency Vermont, but add something to the sort of customer experience of getting through what is a technical challenge, in some cases a sort of confusing or, you know, an inconvenient process. It's hard to be at work and have someone working in the basement of your home at the same time. We are able to help homeowners through that part of the process, and I'd love to see that continue.
So, Ludi, I hear you saying that, in fact, more guidance and perhaps more help in actually getting through the process and figuring out what is best for customers would be something that you think Efficiency Vermont could really help people with.
Yes. Well, help us, because we're here on the ground in Rutland County, and we have organizations in other parts of the county where we can actually go to the home and help with a question or help with, you know, is this the right thing to do, you know, in my home? So, yes, that's a part of the equation that's been successful in getting a lot more people through the process in Rutland County, and I'd love to see it continue and expand.
That's Ludi Biddle. She's the executive director of NeighborWorks of Western Vermont. Ludi, thank you for your perspective. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jim Merriam, what about that? What about this idea that Efficiency Vermont may change and evolve with Vermonters' needs? As I mentioned, you are having forums around the state to ask Vermonters, you know, what do you want us to do? What could we be doing better? And how do we work these programs in together and start thinking more about thermal efficiency as well as the other kinds of efficiency that you are typically working on?
That's correct. So over the starting next week, we have three forums, two the following week, and then at the beginning of December, an additional three forums. And the point of those forums is to really listen to Vermonters in terms of what is top of mind to them, how can our services actually provide a value to them, and what challenges are they facing. So some of the things that we're thinking about that we would like feedback on is kind of building off what Ludi had mentioned, is how do we get more people to participate in being able to get their homes weatherized, and what are the barriers that they're facing? One of the concepts we'd like to toss out to people is, right now, as Ludi mentioned, we have a home performance with Energy Star program. It's a fairly comprehensive program. Are there things that we can do to make that a little bit easier? So kind of like a good, better, best approach, where people can take smaller bites at the apple to get to being able to achieve that 30% savings that Ludi talked about. But maybe not every Vermonter can afford that first bite to get you to 30%. So that's one concept we'd like to throw out. Are there financing challenges that people are having? what is it that if you thought about doing an efficiency project and you were thinking about financing, why did you stop? We're really trying to figure out what are those things that we can deploy to really help Vermonters.
We're talking today about Efficiency Vermont. It's a utility here in the state, helps Vermonters save electricity, and it works in a number of different ways with consumers on an individual level, but also thinking about statewide savings. If you have a question about how it works, or if you want to talk about the new directions that the state might go in this arena, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking with Jim Merriam, Executive Director of Efficiency Vermont, about how his utility functions in the state and about ways Vermonters can use less electricity. That's been the mission of Efficiency Vermont since it started in 2000. These days, a lot of Vermonters are asking for help with thermal efficiency, and Efficiency Vermont is rethinking how it might help with that in addition. Let us know what questions you have. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Ray who says, as an active energy engineer, Efficiency Vermont's proposed new promotion of cold climate heat pumps has me concerned. This new program seeks to replace fossil fuel heating with electrically fueled heat pumps. These units, if widely embraced by homeowners, will contribute significantly to both the winter and summer electrical peak demand on our utilities. Isn't this program antithetical to Efficiency Vermont's mission to minimize electrical consumption and reduce the peak day demand on the electrical system? So won't this eventually lead to higher electric rates? Jim, address that, because heat pumps, this is a new project. You've got support from the legislature to do this. So explain how you think this fits the mission.
Sure. So first off, if people aren't familiar with heat pumps, just to kind of explain that, it's a technology that is kind of, in simple terms, like a refrigerator run backwards. So a lot of times when we think about electric heat, we think about electric heat of the 70s, which, you know, frankly, was part of the reason Efficiency Vermont was created, was to eliminate that. And in those particular cases, you know, one unit in, one unit out. What we're talking about now with heat pumps is technologies that actually allow you to put one unit in and get three units out. So it's a much different technology, and it's much more efficient. And in terms of summer and winter, heat pumps are both air conditioners and heaters. So to kind of break down some of those questions that were there, first off is we're not trying to promote heat pumps as replacing the traditional heating systems that people have in their homes. They're a supplement to that. But what we have to remember is that heat pumps operate at about half the cost of fuel oil. And the economic argument for Vermonters who need to save money, who are struggling, is they should have access to this technology. So what we're trying to do is recognize that there's a moral imperative to provide this technology. And if we're installing this technology, how do we make sure we install the most efficient products that are there? And how do we help mitigate those very real concerns about summer and winter peak? So that may mean we've got to weatherize the home so that we're not needlessly wasting that energy when we're using it. But it really comes down to balancing the economic needs of Vermonters and trying to do all that we can do to make sure that we don't put the strain on the grid that rightly was brought up.
But that issue of weatherizing the home to make sure that it's a well-sealed home when you're putting in something like a heat pump, Efficiency Vermont has very limited funding to do that kind of work, that weatherizing, right?
One of the things that came out of this legislation that you're referring to is more authority that when a heat pump is going in, that we can use some electric funds to be able to weatherize those homes. Because at that point in time, we are offsetting electric use. So that makes complete sense. So that was one of the steps that was identified in this legislation that went through.
So you already are sort of rethinking your mission in some ways as you go through this process. Let's talk with Stephen Letender. He is a professor of economics and environmental studies at Green Mountain College. Professor Letender, nice to talk with you.
Good afternoon.
So what do you think needs to be done in terms of energy efficiency here? And given that both the budget and the mission of Efficiency Vermont, is it doing a good job?
You know, I do. I think, Vermonters are lucky. Efficiency Vermont is held up as a national model of success, and so I think that's pretty exciting. And it's also, kind of, there's a lot of discussion in this state about what we call an all-fuel standard. Oftentimes, we think about energy in these kind of silos. You've got electrical energy, you've got thermal energy, then you've got the energy that you use for transportation. And so I think the conversation really needs to broaden across those three sectors. In particular, the Public Service Department here in Vermont has set a very ambitious goal of achieving 90% renewable energy sources by 2050, and that's across all those sectors. So I think what we're seeing with Efficiency Vermont is exciting. They've really done a great job on the efficiency side. Someone famously called that megawatts.
Mega with an N, like negative, yeah.
And so so now we see Efficiency Vermont moving more and towards the home weatherization and thermal energy issues. And then ultimately, I think we need to even move even further and begin to think about electrifying our transportation sector. Similar to heat pumps, the fuel for powering an electric vehicle is much using electricity is much less expensive than using gasoline to drive vehicles. So really, I think the conversation efficiency is the starting point, and we as a state need to think more broadly about all these different areas where we use energy. We want to be as efficient as we can in using that energy and then begin the transition towards cleaner sources of energy.
Well, how do you propose that we do that as a state? I mean, that's a big mission and a big goal, but how do you think we can actually get there realistically?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and there was just a conference last week. Renewable Energy Vermont hosted their annual conference, and there was a tremendous amount of conversation on that very topic. How do we as a state really take on these large challenges? And I think we need to recognize that funding is going to be, you know, an important part of that equation, an important part of the answer to that question. And so as an economist, we understand that energy that we consume has these what we call external costs, these spillover costs in terms of cost to future generations for climate change, the cost associated with emissions, et cetera. And so that basic economic concept suggests that in order to address those external costs, we have to think about ways that we can invest in renewables and efficiency. And there are any number of proposals that have been put out there, everything from a carbon tax to a surcharge on oil or other fuels that we could use to invest in efficiency in the transition to renewable forms of energy.
Stephen Latunder is a professor of economics and environmental studies at Green Mountain College. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective here as we look at how to increase our efficiency and what the use and mission of Efficiency Vermont is. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We're talking about that today, and listeners, hearing from some of you. If you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Alan, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm an energy consultant and worked closely with Efficiency Vermont over the years, as well as Burlington Electric and Vermont Gas, who also have excellent programs. But I was on the Thermal Energy Task Force, and one of the findings from that was behavior change, which is really more as a future way to further enhance our reduce our energy use. And because the culture at Efficiency Vermont is so obsessed with the reporting of savings, they can't really quantify how much energy savings there is from behavior changes. And that is a large area that I think we could stop a lot of energy from being wasted if we could just allow them to help people use their energy more effectively.
Alan, thanks for your thoughts. Jim Merriam, what about that?
That's a great question. I like to think of it in terms of engagement. Behavior sounds a little controlling. We are actually piloting a program starting within a month or so, and it is in partnership this particular time with Green Mountain Power. We hope to expand to other utilities if we determine that it's cost effective. But what it really is a program that allows customers to understand how they compare to others. So it provides context in terms of how they use energy compared to others, and then gives tips on what they can do to save energy. And this is a program that is actually currently deployed across the United States, been very successful, been audited and assessed in terms of how valuable it is. And what we're doing in conjunction with the Public Service Department through this pilot is determining in Vermont first and foremost, is this something that Vermonters appreciate and value and can get value out of? And is this going to be able to deliver cost-effective savings? So kind of going back to the top of the show where I talked about how Efficiency Vermont delivers savings at half the cost of generated power, we have to keep that in mind. So through this test or this pilot, if we don't feel that that's actually going to help contribute to that overall benefit that we deliver, then we won't be continuing it forward. But to Alan's point, that is something we're going to pilot.
And is this the smart meter program? We got a note from Donna who's wondering when Green Mountain Power and Efficiency Vermont are going to better utilize the smart meters that we all have so that people are able to help reduce both their costs and demand.
So this program will certainly rely on the smart meters to be able to use that information to better inform the suggestions in terms of what people can do to save energy? Absolutely. And we're looking at other ways that we can use those smart meters to be able to really benefit people. So this summer, we rolled out a program with respect to some of the manufacturers across the state, which was to really identify what are those times when they're using so much power that it actually sets what's called their peak charge. And through using that information and that data, we're actually able to help those businesses alter their process or buy new equipment so they can eliminate that charge.
As we wrap up this conversation today, let's bring in Tim Ash. He's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and it was the legislature that established the framework for Efficiency Vermont back in 1999. So the legislature will need to look at this again as we figure out what to do in the future. Senator Ash, nice to have you on the program.
Good afternoon, Jane.
So is the legislature likely to take up thermal efficiency and how Efficiency Vermont operates in this upcoming session?
Yeah, I think as you've been discussing the heat pump issue, I think that highlights why the legislature really has to start undertaking this discussion. One of the major mind shifts that is occurring is, as you've noted, whether it's Efficiency Vermont or Burlington Electric, which manages its own efficiency program, the mantra has always been consume less power, use less electricity. And now we're realizing that we have really two goals. We want to reduce electric consumption and save people money. We also want to reduce carbon emissions, which is something that hasn't really come up today. And all across the state, there are people using heating oil to heat their homes. And it's clear that heat pumps are an opportunity, certainly, to reduce their carbon emissions. The question is, how do we change the mindset that the legislature has had to say that there might be instances where using more electricity is actually a beneficial social policy? So we're in the ground stages. Legislation that my committee worked on is what authorized Efficiency Vermont to move forward with what I'd call a little bit of a pilot project with the Public Service Board right now.
While we have you on the line, let's go to Ryan, who's calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Jane. Well, this Monday at 3 p.m., there's going to be a big rally and sit-in for climate justice, probably the biggest in Vermont's history. And people are gathering because there's a track gas pipeline being proposed in Addison County that's going to cost $130 million, over $100. And that's a 40% increase from what Vermont Gas had applied for. I'm wondering what that amount of money could do for if it was put towards efficiency and conservation. This is going to be money incurred by the ratepayers. How can we call on our lawmakers to put those kind of resources towards efficiency and conservation as opposed to new fossil fuel infrastructure projects?
Senator Ash, what about that? I mean, you're talking here about ways that the legislature can work on different kinds of efficiency. So, you know, Ryan obviously sort of taking us in a different direction there, but can you bring it back to what we're talking about here and the mission of Efficiency Vermont and address Ryan's concerns about how the state is spending money?
Well, I think that one of the important threads that's starting to tie together electric utilities, our gas utility, Efficiency Vermont, and others is a real concern that the ratepayers' pocketbooks need to be guarded more closely. And there's a lot of concern right now about the ability of the Public Service Board when it makes its decisions. Also, the Public Service Department, which is supposed to be representing ratepayers. And I think people feel that perhaps there's a little bit more leeway being given to the utilities and a little less consideration for ratepayers' costs. So I think there's legislation, I think, being drafted both in the House and Senate that will probably alter the way the Public Service Department is arranged to make sure that they're better looking out for ratepayers.
That's Tim Ash. He's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. Thank you for sharing just a brief perspective here with us today, Senator Ash.
Thank you.
Jim Marion, before we let you go, you're not going to be around probably to see much of this come to fruition. You're actually leaving Efficiency Vermont. And where are you headed? Eventually.
Not very far. I'm actually taking on a different role within the organization that operates Efficiency Vermont, Vermont Energy Investment Corporation. So I'll be overseeing the new director of Efficiency Vermont, as well as a program we run down in Washington, D.C., and some programs we run in Ohio.
But no timeline on that. You're not in a hurry to find a new director.
I want to make sure we find a great individual.
Jim Merriam is, for now, the executive director of Efficiency Vermont. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that will do it. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to speak with progressive Dean Corin. Yesterday, I talked with Republican Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. So tomorrow, we're going to have his challenger on the program. We'll hear his stances on health care, property taxes, and he'll take your questions. So you can email your questions now for Dean Corin to vermontedition@vpr.net. And then listen to the discussion tomorrow at noon and 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Isla Yersel. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.